Attention listeners, AfterSight's annual hike is coming up on July 27th.
It was a really good experience for me.
Visit aftersight.org/hike and become an audio trekker today.
That hike today gave me so much courage.
You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the April 28th, 2024, Sunday's reading of the Loveland Reporter-Herald. My name is Shanine Shanahan. Today we'll be reading the following main articles. Municipal Court Doesn't Have Jurisdiction by Ken Amundsen. New Strategy Propels Legislation by Seth Kleman and Nick Coltrane. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Greeley Judge. Municipal Court Doesn't Have Jurisdiction by Kim Amundsen. Greeley Municipal Court Judge Mark Gonzalez, who had agreed to handle two municipal court cases from Loveland involving city council members, has ruled that municipal court does not have jurisdiction. Russell Sinnott, the Loveland attorney who filed the cases on behalf of the Loveland residents, said he will appeal that ruling to 8th Judicial District Court in hopes of a ruling to remand the cases back to municipal court where he thinks they belong. The cases, Ball v. City of Loveland and Gasley v. City of Loveland, allege violations of the city charter. In the Ball case, Richard Ball is among 8 residents and former city council members who say that the new members of the Loveland City Council violated the charter when they failed to call for a public vote on the rescission of Sentara South. The new provision was added in November by Loveland voters. In the Gasley case, Peter Gasley, who had been a candidate in Ward 1, alleged that the city's failure to conduct a background check on Troy Krenning prior to placing him on the ballot also violated the charter. Gonzalez noted in an earlier hearing some skepticism over whether municipal court has jurisdiction. He asked the parties to write briefs on the matter, which they did. On Friday, he ruled that the court did not have jurisdiction. Quote, his reasoning was that no matter what he decided, one side or the other would appeal, which we will, Sinnott told BizWiz. The remedy we seek is to have the case remanded back to municipal court. Sinnott wrote in his brief that Loveland established the municipal court with the creation of its charter in 1996. He cited the charter language. Quote, there shall be a municipal court vested with jurisdiction over matters arising under the charter and ordinances of the city. The municipal court shall be a court of record. The grant of authority, he said, quote, does not distinguish between criminal and civil cases, nor by whom any action may be commenced. Michael Pleche and Angela Vichik of the law firm Lewis Rocha Rothgerber Christie LLP, the Denver law firm engaged by the city council because of a potential conflict of interest of the city's attorney's office, argued instead that the municipal court does not have authority to handle civil cases filed by citizens. Quote, the Loveland Charter does not expressly or impliedly authorize private citizens to bring civil claims in municipal court, but does not expressly prohibit them from doing so. Also, quote, Loveland Municipal Court is a court of limited, not general, jurisdiction, unquote. And the actions of Gasley and Ball should have been brought to district court, they argued. Quote, no Loveland ordinance contemplates a civil claim being brought by a private citizen in municipal court, they said. The city's attorneys also argued that a remedy sought by the actions, removal of 5 members of the council from their elected roles, requires a decree, quote, tantamount to a writ of quo warranto, which under Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure can be brought only in district court. The writ mentioned is a common law remedy to challenge a person's right to hold a public office. Gasley's case, the attorneys argued, should have been brought in a district court because election matters can only be heard there. The filing of that case exceeded the time limitations permitted for election law cases, they said. Sinnott, in a statement sent by email to BizWest, said he will appeal but also understands the judge's position. Quote, I find it difficult to fault the judge for his finding. The court is between a rock and a hard place. If Judge Gonzalez hears this case without proper jurisdiction or an order of remand from a district court, an entire trial could get thrown out the window. He's asked us to either appeal the decision and get an answer that he has jurisdiction or start again at the level of the district court. The problem is if we file the complaints in district court and start over, the district court could find on its own that it is not the court of the original jurisdiction and send it back to municipal court anyway. Either way, the wrangling over jurisdiction is simply delaying the inevitable. If, on appeal, there is a ruling that Loveland's municipal courts have no jurisdiction to hear civil matters of a part of any claims arising under the city's charter, then the Loveland city government is not functioning as the Home Rule Charter Commission intended back in 1996, he wrote. The cases are Peter M. Gasley versus the City of Loveland, case number SP24-002 in Greeley Municipal Court, or 24CV-002 in Loveland Municipal Court. Ball et al. Versus City of Loveland, case number SP24-001 in Greeley Municipal Court, or 24CV-001 in Loveland Municipal Court. Land use reform. New strategy propels legislation. Lawmakers, advocates say extra time, split up approach are helping, by Seth Kleman and Nick Coltrane. At this time last year, Colorado lawmakers were preparing to gut Governor Jared Polis's massive and marquee land use bill that would have reshaped zoning across the state, spurring a stalemate that preceded the proposal's death. Now, after reviving most of that proposal in smaller pieces as part of a new strategy, reform supporters see a finish line in sight. Hurdles remain, but backers hope to avoid brick walls like the one that doomed last year's effort. One measure, a ban on most occupancy limits, has already been signed into law. Other legislation has crossed between chambers, including bills that would encourage and then require denser residential development in transit-rich areas, eliminate minimum parking requirements, require housing studies by all local governments, and allow for accessory dwelling units to be built on single-family lots. Unlike last year's failed proposal, which had been introduced to a cheering crowd, the bills are advancing without lawmakers publicly sharpening their pencils for planned rewrites. But the underlying tensions surrounding how to require or incentivize local governments to undertake long-term planning and denser development along transit corridors haven't been erased either. The three bills that passed the House and now are headed to the Senate each include limitations on local government's ability to control land use decisions, a major source of tension last year, particularly in the Senate. Another bill is on the opposite track, moving to the House. With 2 weeks left in the legislative session, which is set to end May 8th, negotiations in each chamber will determine whether any of the policies passed get rewritten or die once again. The House and Senate, while both controlled by large Democratic majorities, also have disagreed markedly on how to address the state's housing crisis, adding complications. The House passed the density near transit measure, House Bill 1313, with key and controversial provisions in place. That was a way for representatives to strengthen their hand heading into negotiations with the more moderate Senate in the coming days. In a nod to the politicking ahead, lawmakers, advocates, and lobbyists involved in the discussions have struck an even careful tone in recent days when describing their expectations for the bills. Officials on either side of the debate praised their opponents and spoke openly about working together to bridge disagreements. Quote, it seems like the differences between the House and Senate are less severe this year on this issue, said Senate President Steve Fenberg, a Boulder Democrat. Quote, I think part of the problem last year was that it's all one bill. That meant some people who supported, say, the provision allowing more accessory dwelling units may have hated the transit-oriented development piece or another component. Quote, it's different when they're separate policies. You can digest each individual policy on its own, and it creates a clearer debate, Fenberg said. The four remaining bills, which mostly would apply to Front Range cities, aren't guaranteed to pass, all will almost certainly change. Lawmakers have now had more than a year to consider the broader idea of state-led zoning reform and to work on building consensus. Supporters have taken pains to be more open about the bill's contents. That it's marked contrast from last year, when the details of the larger reform bill were kept under wraps until March, and local government officials protested that they were learning about its contours from reports in the media. The new approach has cleared some barriers and made for a smoother debate so far, but it hasn't assuaged a fundamental disagreement about land use reform and who should handle it. That's a gap that likely can't be bridged no matter how many Zoom meetings or stakeholder discussion lawmakers and backers organize. Quote, it's a better process, which I think is why you'll see that we're trying to work supporters a little more on getting something passed, because we do want to see something passed with housing, said Heather Stauffer, a legislative advocacy manager for the Colorado Municipal League. It represents cities and towns around the state that it has opposed many of the reforms. Quote, we're not in a position to say nothing should pass around housing, she said. We just want to make sure structurally that it works for local governments as well. The League has had particular concerns about the density bill. It broadly would require local governments on the Front Range to come up with a minimum housing density goal near transit areas and then pursue strategies to hit that goal. Obituaries. Charles E. Maupin. February 13, 1943 to April 20, 2024, Charlie Maupin passed away at the Veterans Home of Wyoming Saturday, April 20th. He spent his younger years doing concrete work in Loveland with his father and brothers. Later he traveled, and now he is traveling home. Viewing will be Tuesday, April 30th, 2024 at the Kippy Fishburne Funeral Home, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. Graveside services Wednesday, May 1st, 2024 at 10 a.m. at Loveland Burial Park. Patrick Michael Webb, age 57, formerly of Colorado, passed away unexpectedly on Tuesday, April 23, 2024, at his home in Hubbard, Iowa. For more information and online condolences, go to www.boekefuneralhomes.com. Irene Betts of Loveland, Celebration of Life Service, 2 p.m. Friday at Kibbe Fishburne Funeral Home. Marilyn L. Bylin of Loveland, Graveside Inurnment, Monday, 10 a.m. at Rest Haven Memory Gardens. Blaine Brown of Loveland, Cremation, Arrangements Pending. Once-in-a-generation opportunity, former college campus, Sprout Schools, Housing, by Megan Ululani Boynton. In South Park Hill, a former college campus is gradually being transformed, and what's taking shape doesn't look like a typical redevelopment project in Denver. In one building on the Mosaic Community Campus on a recent sunny Friday afternoon, Dirt Coffee Bar had just closed after a day of selling cappuccinos and training baristas with intellectual disabilities or neurological conditions. Nearby, a clerk smiled behind the counter at the Helping Hen Cafe. There, students facing barriers such as housing insecurity or criminal convictions receive free culinary job training through the nonprofit Work Options. Next door, four former dormitories were gated off in a construction zone, soon to be converted into low-cost apartments. Yards away, a pair of teachers watched as children played on the lawn in front of St. Elizabeth's School, a K-8 Episcopal school. The community-centered approach to redeveloping the former Johnson & Wales University campus follows a non-traditional model in Denver's redevelopment-hungry urban landscape. The organizations that bought the 25-acre property are repurposing historic buildings in a way that combines affordable housing, education programs for children and adults, and work opportunities, all within walking distance of each other. Quote, I never thought I would be able to do something like this, said Aaron Mirapol, president and CEO of the Urban Land Conservancy, the nonprofit that purchased the land by joining with public partners. Quote, this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity. And there's more coming on the multi-use Mosaic campus. In the northeast corner, two buildings owned by the Denver Housing Authority could soon host migrant families. On the property, south side, one of four buildings belonging to Denver Public Schools, is slated to open in the fall following an expansion from the Denver School of Art's current location just north of the campus. The site first hosted students in 1909 as the Colorado Women's College and later is the site of the University of Denver Law School. In 2000, it became one of Providence, Rhode Island-based Johnson & Wales satellite campuses. The property is seeing new life after the Urban Land Conservancy bought it in 2021, following the university's decision to leave Denver. The nonprofit utilizes a community land trust to own the land, then partners with other organizations that rent the land or buildings at a deep discount or, in some cases, purchase the existing structures. This community is part of the vision that Mirapol had when the campus along Montview Boulevard first was put on the market. The community-centered plan shares similarities with another major college campus redevelopment at Loretto Heights in southwest Denver. That 72-acre campus plan includes affordable and market-rate housing, office space and retail, along with civic buildings, but it's being led by a private developer. The Mosaic plan in East Denver fits with the Urban Land Conservancy's larger mission. It buys land and buildings throughout Metro Denver, strategically focusing on properties near transit stations and corridors. Once it makes an acquisition, the organization works with its new neighbors to figure out their greatest need, whether that's building affordable housing or opening schools or Boys and Girls Clubs, Mirapol said. Quote, "We're focusing our real estate purchase into neighborhoods generally where we've seen dramatic displacement," he said. "How do we play a role to lessen that?" In the case of former university campus, the opportunity for historic preservation in the proximity to the Colfax Avenue corridor and the adjacent East Colfax neighborhood, an ethnically diverse area facing affordability pressures, made it an appealing investment. The Urban Land Conservancy joined with Denver Public Schools and the Denver Housing Authority to purchase the property for $62.5 million. The ULC now owns the land and more than half of the campus. While the nonprofit doesn't manage all of the property's green space, its intention is to maintain its portion as a neighborhood amenity. Archway Communities bought two dorm buildings from the ULC in late 2021, then another two in late 2022, quote, at a significant discount, Mirapol said. After Archway finishes renovations, it plans to lease more than 150 apartments later this year at rents affordable to lower-income residents. Plans for more affordable housing are still in flux and may shift to meet a recent need. The DHA purchased 3 acres, including land and two former dorm buildings, with plans to offer a combined 72 apartments. The long-term goal remains to convert the buildings into permanent affordable housing, spokesperson Allison Tremblay said, with the intention to select a development partner this year. But DHA and city officials now are, quote, exploring options for operating the buildings in the near term for migrant families resettling in our community as they seek employment, educational opportunities, and permanent housing options, she said. Denver mayoral spokesperson Jordan Fuha confirmed the administration was in talks about housing migrants on the Mosaic campus, but added that, quote, we have not made any final decisions. While the housing projects are still underway and evolving, the Mosaic Community Campus's education programs have taken root. After serving for 2 decades as a dean at Johnson & Wales, a private university known for its culinary education, Jorge de la Torre has watched the campus change firsthand. The chef used to work with students paying $30,000 in annual tuition and fees. Today, De La Torre is helping community members who likely couldn't afford that price tag. Quote, now that this has been open, a lot of people who have never been able to set foot on this campus in these beautiful kitchens and buildings are getting a chance to enjoy what's already here, he said. De La Torre serves as the Director of Culinary Arts at Kitchen Network, a nonprofit food business incubator owned by Buku West, an organization that supports small business growth in Denver. It's one of the tenants leasing buildings from the Urban Land Conservancy. Another is St. Elizabeth's, a private school that offers sliding scale tuition. Kitchen Network, her demands to expand its presence from Denver's Westwood neighborhood to the city's east side, De La Torre said, and the Mosaic campus made for an ideal setting. Its two culinary-focused buildings include 9 kitchens, 2 dining rooms, and classroom space. An added bonus, their workers will be able to, quote, live and work on the same campus, he said. We're going to bring some affordable housing to people that might not have the ability to live in Denver. The property is located in a food desert, which leaves residents with limited access to healthy, low-cost food. Kitchen Network plans to be part of the solution by offering lunchtime options to its neighbors. The restaurants Cholan Modern Asian and D-Bar are also setting up for for-profit commissaries, De La Torre said. On campus, a cancer nutrition research group is in the works, and Rocky Mountain Chefs of Colorado is holding classes for its apprenticeship program. Quote, every nonprofit within a 5-mile radius of here, if we can help them, we're here, De La Torre said. De La Torre, the son of Bolivian immigrants, now has the chance to help local Hmong, Thai, and Ethiopian residents. While many are already talented at cooking, he says, he assists them with costs, permitting, and more before they move on to start their own brick-and-mortar restaurants or food trucks. Quote, this campus should be a welcoming place for everybody to the east, west, north, and south of us, he said. This is going to have a diverse crowd of people now. Cody Baker resides on a side street on the south side of campus and often walks his dog through the area. Quote, it looks nice. I can tell that they're making progress on things, he said on the front steps of his home on Tuesday afternoon. Although Baker said he wasn't deeply familiar with the details behind the project, quote, it's probably not a bad thing. Greater Park Hill Community Incorporated, the area's registered neighborhood organization, hasn't taken a position on the redevelopment of the former college campus, said Chair Shane Sutherland, but residents have been curious. City Councilwoman Chantel Lewis, a first-term member whose Northeast Denver district includes the Mosaic campus, says she hears questions from her constituents about plans for the campus and their potential impact on the community. Those questions prompted her to get more involved, and she pushed to be a part of the administration's discussions with DHA over the housing plans, including for migrants. Quote, there is opportunity for growth, I think, with the administration and the folks who are really leading this project to ensure that they are bringing community alongside them as they are planning and executing, she said. WizKids, science doesn't have to be stuffy. CSU Spur launches educational YouTube program to reach youth locally and beyond by Elizabeth Hernandez. In a bedazzled lab coat, Converse sneakers, and glasses that answer the question, what if a hipster wore safety goggles, Angelica Peterson had her bespectacled eyes set on creating captivating children's educational programming. As she filmed Friday at Colorado State University's Spur campus in Denver, Peterson's Taylor Swift-esque friendship bracelet, dangling with charms that included a silver microscope, spelled out her stage name, WizKid. For WizKid and the team of CSU employees behind her, all the world's a stage. The university this month launched a new YouTube series named after the character and based out of the Spur campus near the National Western Complex. In the series, WizKid explores the free interactive educational center and questions in-house experts and researchers on kid-friendly topics. In one episode, WizKid interviewed a CSU horticulturist to learn about plants. In another, she demonstrated at-home chemistry experiments. Yet another highlighted the science behind making bread, butter, and cheese. Quote, what Spur is trying to do at its core is reach out to young people early in their lives and inspire them and show them role models and move past the narrative that maybe college isn't for them, CSU Chancellor Tony Frake said. WizKid is a perfect little microcosm of that philosophy. The goal is to create accessible educational children's programming that could reach anyone with an internet connection, whether they're a kid in a Colorado classroom or a learner across the globe, said Peterson, whose day job at CSU, digital media specialist. Quote, we have our eyes set for the entire United States and even the world, she said. Channeling Bill Nye, the science guy, but, quote, with Eras Tour energy, Peterson is proud to have debuted the first 6-episode season of the YouTube show and promises plenty more hijinks on video, social media, and in person at live events. Quote, science doesn't have to be stuffy, she said. WizKid is about a year in the making, said CSU Associate Vice President of Communications Tiana Kennedy. And the program was born out of a desire to personify the elements CSU Spur focuses on: food, water, and health. The Spur campus's three buildings, Vita, Terra, and Hydro, are full of free child activities like a veterinary hospital behind a glass wall that allows families to watch live operations or visit a rooftop greenhouse. The campus provides an ideal playground for WizKid, whose fun and quirky personality comes to life in front of the camera. Last week, Peterson skipped through the Spur buildings while filming social media content for Earth Day, swinging around a banana peel as she talked about composting. The content is aimed at elementary to middle school audience, she said. For the remainder of this article, please visit the Reporter Herald. Thank you for joining us for the Loveland Reporter Herald. My name is Shaneen Shanahan.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.